There's a buzz. That means people are talking. I like it. And the reason why is we're going to start a little bit different this morning. I saw this and thought, man, that's a good idea. What I have up here is a dollar, and we are going to auction off this dollar. Now, here's the rules. You're welcome to bid, but not only will the winner of the auction pay whatever it is they bid for it, but whoever comes in second is also going to pay that amount also. A Yale professor does this every year. So for instance, if we started auctioning off and Billy bids one penny and Mitzi outbids him two pennies and Mitzi wins the auction, then she'll pay her two pennies and Billy will pay one penny. Okay, so that's how it works. But you could get a really good deal on this for this dollar. Do I have anybody who would like to open the bid for the dollar? No, this is a regular dollar. Now, the Yale professor, the reason why I said this is, the Yale professor, and this is a psychology professor, I believe, has come to realize that people have some different traits. One, there's this, you could call it fear of missing out, is kind of a familiar way of looking at it, but that there's the idea of loss, like loss prevention. We don't want to lose out. Like, I don't want to lose out on something, especially for a deal. But then there's also, well, a lot of times people are just competitive. And so that they get competitiveness, and so that's why sometimes with church, like cake auctions and whatever, you can get some big-time money for some church cakes, because there's that competitive nature of, I want to win. But then there's also a commitment escalation. That's why in marketing, so oftentimes, they just want to make you to commit to something small, and then once you've committed, then that commitment's going to keep going. And the reason I wanted to do this is because that Yale professor, every year, he has never auctioned it off, I don't think, for less than a dollar. And in fact, he has had people bid over $200 each, which means he raked in $400 off of his dollar that he was auctioning off. Now, why is it that people would do that? Because we have a fear of missing out, and so that starts driving it. Even whenever you start bidding, like the first time whenever somebody says, I'll bid a dollar, and somebody says, I'll give you $1.05, like you have to realize that's not a good return in your investment. Of course, there's also the idea that the second person's already going to pay. Well, okay, I know that he bid a dollar, but if I bid, I'm on the hook for 95 cents right now, and he bid a dollar, but I could either just lose my 95 cents, or if I bid 105, then I'm only out 5 cents and not 95 cents. And so they ration it out in their head, and they keep on going and going and going until they get to just absurd amounts of money, in my opinion, paying $200 for a $1 bill. But there's those things that just get in our head. The heart is deceitful above all else. The mind ain't far behind it. We can do some crazy things. And so whenever we've been looking at the book of Job, he lived faithfully. He was blessed and everything got taken away. And so he starts working and his mind starts working. And he ends up in this point where even though he does better than his friends, he still ends up kind of calling God to account. In fact, God says that he's a contender, that he's a fault finder, is what it says. And it's easy for us oftentimes to get caught up in our own minds and our own hearts and to think that, well, maybe God has done something wrong. Oh, we would never say that God does anything wrong. Of course, God is perfect. But like so many other things, we think, oh, well, maybe this one time he overlooked something. Maybe he missed the picture this one time. But God ends up coming to Job, and this is what it says in Job chapter 40. Now remember, from last week, God's already spent two chapters, already spent a big amount of time saying, Job, what do you know? You don't know what you think you know. Were you there when I laid the foundation? Who hung the stars in their place? Who makes the planets work the way they work? Who knows when the mountain goats are going to give birth? He says, what do you know about the eagles? Do you even know what's going on? And so he calls out for two chapters. And by this time, if I was Job, I would be feeling this little. Because, I mean, God has called him to task. And Job has got to be like, you're right, I don't know. I thought I knew. I don't know anything. But now God stops almost at a pause. And he says, will the one who contends with the Almighty correct him? Let him who argues with God give an answer. Your translation might say that fault finder. Will the fault finder, will the one that finds fault, as if somebody's got to be wrong and maybe God messed up this time. Will the fault finder? In Moana, we watch a lot of little Disney movies at our house. In Moana, too, they have, Moana is a wayfinder. And it's kind of what part of the premise is a wayfinder finds a way when there is no way. Well, that's kind of the same thing. God is saying, look, are you trying to find fault where there is no fault? Are you just trying to dig up something? Rather than Job just acknowledging that God is right and he's wrong, he's kind of like Fonzie from Happy Days. And he can't say that he's wrong. Nowadays, the version that I see going around nowadays is that they say, look, my wife can read good, onomatopoeia, and she reads all these words, and then it says sorry on the board, and she's like, sure, sure. And we laugh at those kind of things, but here it is with God saying, look, you fault finder, you that would contend with me, you that would dare have the audacity to say, hey, God, I know you normally get things right, but in this one case, this is an exception, God, and he calls God to task. And so he says, let him who argues with God give an answer. And Job answered the Lord, I'm so insignificant. How can I answer you? How can I answer you? I placed my hand over my mouth. I've spoken once, and that I will not reply twice, but I can add nothing. You see, Job forgot that God is always right. As black and white as yes or no. This is, and when it comes to school, you've got the STEM with math and science where there is a right answer. And then you've got the humanities where people want to say, well, I think this is right. I think this is right. Well, emotions lead me here. And God is a STEM God. He is a God that it is factually yes and no. It's not my interpretation. It's not what I wish would happen. It's God is the God of all goodness, all righteousness, all truth. It is all Him. He is the correct answer. He is the only answer. And so for Job to come and say, well, God, you're perfect, but perfect looks a little swayed right now. For him to even bring that into question is wrong. And so now God comes and he doesn't ask Job some more questions. He's going to get ready. He says, get ready to answer me like a man and I will question you. You inform me. That's like he said in chapter 38. But whereas in 38 he said, who obscures counsel without knowledge? Talking about this is what you don't know. He says, would you really challenge my justice? Would you declare me guilty to justify yourself? Do you have an arm like God's? Can you thunder with a voice like his? He says, you didn't know. Now I'm going to show you that you don't have the power. You aren't able to carry it out. You don't know justice. You can't handle justice. You couldn't affect justice in any way. Would you declare me guilty or condemn? It's kind of like whenever Jesus went and raised Lazarus from the dead. Lazarus had died. He had been dead for 4 days. And Jesus strolls up on the scene. And Martha comes to him and says, oh, Lord, if you were here, you could have kept him from dying. As if God is, this is your fault. If you were just here, then this wouldn't have happened. And as in that situation, Job, kind of the same situation with Job, like blame has got to be somewhere, and it can't be me. We've got to find somebody to blame. We've got to lay the blame somewhere, and so we blame God. When things don't work out and we think we're in the right, then we've got to find blame somewhere. If you've ever had a budget, like even our church budget, so this past Wednesday, if you weren't here for a business meeting, you know, we voted to fix something out of the roof, we voted to do something with the stove, we voted to do some things, and the question always arises is, well, where does the money come from? And the answer is, well, it comes out of this line item or this line item, but at the end of the day, it all comes out of the same place. Because the repair line item and the upkeep line item, they're just line items that designate on paper where the money is. But in reality, all the money is in the same bank account. The bank that has the money doesn't have different lockers and say, this is this money, this is this money. It's all the money in the same thing, regardless of where we call it. And so in placing the blame, Job is looking at what happened. And he's looking at it, and he's looking at it, and he says, I used to be blessed. I used to have my family. I used to have sheep. I used to have camels. I used to have everything was going good, my health. And now we've got to find somewhere to put the blame. He's wanting to assign that light item to God. His friends were wanting to say, that line item, all of this bad stuff happened because of you, Job. And Job's like, it's not me, it must be God, because it's not me. And so he's wanting to play the line item on God, the blame on God, instead of just saying, this is what happened. This is what happened in your life, Job. Does assigning the blame help you out? And are you really going to go before God to do something? He says, no. Let's talk about this, because you don't have an arm like God. Do you have an arm like God? In Deuteronomy 4, it talks about how God delivered his people with a strong hand and an outstretched arm. His arm is that enacts power. Can you thunder with a voice like his? You know, people would like to be able to do a lot of things that sometimes we just can't do. We think we know what's right. But even if we know what's right, that doesn't mean we can figure it out. Any Auburn fans in the room? When that Oklahoma receiver acted like he's going off the field and then catches a touchdown pass, you know he was in the wrong. But could you do anything about it? Could Hugh Freeze do anything about it? Ain't nobody do nothing about it. So even though you think you know that this guy was wrong, and in this case he was wrong, the referees admitted it later, nobody could do anything about it. And here God is saying, look, you think that what's happened to you is my fault. You think that what's happened to you, you're going to judge me. You're going to find fault with me. You're going to condemn me. Well, what are you going to do about it, Job? What could you do about it? We've already talked about how you don't know what the right thing is. You weren't there when I hung the earth. You were not present, for your life is small. You did not know, for your knowledge is limited. And now let's talk about what could you even do in the meantime? In verse 10, it says, adorn yourself with majesty and splendor. Clothe yourselves with honor and glory. There are a lot of people that try to do that. A whole lot of people want to make a whole lot out of themselves. And they literally clothe themselves to make themselves look good. They clothe themselves in what presents well. You wear a suit to look professional. You wear a hoodie because that's what's cool and trendy. You wear what you wear to make a point and to create an illusion. Yet when God clothes himself, it's not as if he's putting on his old favorite t-shirt. God is majestic. He is splendor. Honor and glory belong to him and him alone by his nature and who he is. So people try to fix themselves up. Women spend $1 billion a year on makeup to try and make themselves look better. Men go to the gym, not because they need to get stronger, but because they think it makes them look better, because they want to improve themselves. Yet for all of our trying and all of our pretending and all of our covering up and all of that, we cannot adorn ourselves with a majesty and a splendor that's un and of ourselves. The majesty and the glory that we have is because we're created in the image of God, the image of the one who's glorious, the image of the one that has honor and glory. And so God says, pour out your raging anger. Look on every proud person and humiliate him. Look on every proud person and humble him. Trample the wicked where they stand. Hide them together in the dust. Imprison them in the grave. Then I will confess to you that your own right hand can deliver you. All right, Job, you think you can do better? What you going to do, Job? And oh, the tyrant that we could be. Have you ever thought what it would be like to have the power of Superman, to be able to fly, to have super speed and super strength? Oh, the good things that you could do. You could help everybody. There wouldn't be any problem. Did you ever think about what it would be like? Oh, if I was a billionaire, imagine the number of people I could help. Imagine if I was like Zach Morris, time out, and then you could go mess with people. Imagine the good you could do with that. But here's the problem. What would you actually do with that? How would you actually help people? Oh, I would like to be able to help people. Well, you might would want to be able to help people one or two so that you could feel good about yourself. But if you had enough money to help everybody in the world, imagine the line down the aisle, out the doors, to the edge of town, to the edge of the county, to the edge of Alabama. I mean, Forrest Gump ain't run that far. Imagine the line of people lining up to help. Now, are you really wanting to be able, I wish I had more money so I could help people? Well, all of a sudden that became a burden, and we wouldn't really do it. Imagine if I just had a little bit, if I had a little bit more intelligence, if I had a little bit more schooling, imagine what I could do with it. And at the end of the day, everything turns out like it is with helping people. We end up that it's not long before it ends up getting used for selfish reasons, not the reasons that we really state. Because once again, the heart is deceitful above all else and the mind ain't far behind it. And we can trick ourselves into saying that it's worth it. We can trick ourselves into believing things would be different. But God says, you're not able to do it. You don't know what you need to do, and you're not able to do what you can. Then he goes and talks about two different creatures, the first of which is Behemoth. Behemoth, the name means beast. Like, it's not just a beast. This is a beast. You've heard of a man's man. This is a beast. And so this beast is from Dr. Seuss world. You'd almost think like he is stout and he is strong. He eats grass like cattle. Look at the strength of his back, the power in his muscles of his belly. He stiffens his tail like a cedar tree. The tendons of his thighs are woven firmly together. His bones are bronze tubes. His limbs are like iron rods. He's the foremost of God's work. Only his maker can draw the sword against him. So here we have this animal. Some people think it might be an elephant, but don't really know that it matches up. Some people think that it might be a hippopotamus or maybe a woolly mammoth, like some different animals. Some people think that it's just a mythological creature. But all of the imagery is one that is strong, that is stout, that is immovable, is shakable, that is stout, a beast. And this imposing creature, though, if you keep reading, it says the hills yield food for him while all sorts of wild animals play there. Well, now that sounds very docile. This beast of a beast that's as silent and quiet as a lamb, he lies under the lotus plants, hiding in the protection of marshy reeds. What does this beast need protection from? Lotus plants cover him with their shade. The willows of the brook surround him. Though the river rages, Behemoth is unafraid. He remains confident, even if the Jordan surges up to his mouth. Can anyone capture him while he looks on or pierce his nose with snares? See, this beast of a beast was also one of God's creations. I made him along with you. This beast of a beast that is imposing to us, that is thwarting, that does not have very many natural predators or things that are coming at it, that imposes this, is yet provided for and in need. And if this beast of a beast is in need of God to provide protection, this beast of a beast is in need for God to provide the food, if this beast of a beast, this beast of a beast that can control everything, such an imposing figure, how much more so you that I made along with it? And so whether this beast is the hippopotamus or whether it's some creature that once existed and no longer did, we look at it and we see that strength and majesty that people are clamoring for, the majesty and splendor, the honor, the glory, is not something that is anything other than what is given. And as God has made us a little lower than the angels for now, as God has made us in his image, as God has made us with an intelligence that the animal world does not have, as God created Adam and Eve, mankind, and said, subdue the world, have dominion over it, be fruitful and multiply. As God has made us on the top of the pyramid, we have an honor and a glory, but we cannot overstep that and not see that we're also in desperate need of the provision of God. The sparrows of the field, the lilies of the valley, of the grass, they are clothed in a splendor. So why should we worry about what we wear? Why should we worry about what we eat? God provides for them, yet God also provides for us. And so as we look and God says, look, how do you provide for yourself? Oh, and in America, we want to be providing for ourselves. We want to pull ourselves up by the bootstrap. We want to be a self-made man. We want to be the man. We want to be the one that did it ourselves. I did it my way, we sing about. And the American culture is resplendent with accounts of the little guy rising up, the underdog story, the one that accomplishes what seems like couldn't be done through hard work and determination, through a grit and do-good attitude. And all those things are perfectly well and good as long as we keep it in the proper place, that without God we are nothing, that is he who enables us, that it is He who is the one that is in control of all things. And so we come with the thankfulness of that God created us and made us in His image, that God endowed upon us a soul, that He endowed upon us an intelligence, that He endowed upon us a relationship and the things that He has given it, yet we hold it in trust for Him. And we trust in Jesus, like we sang. And we trust in Him. We have this blessed assurance that Jesus is mine. But remember how the rest of that song goes? He says, praising my Savior all the day long. And so I want to ask you this morning, in real life examples, we talked about this in Sunday school, in real life examples, how do you actually praise Jesus all the day long? How do you actually trust in Jesus? Do we sing, I trust in Jesus, but I better do it myself? Do we actually trust in Jesus? Do we actually praise Him all the day long? Or do we like, that's a good sentiment. I know that's what I'm supposed to think. I know that's what I'm supposed to do. I know that's what I'm supposed to, the right answer is. Or is that what's actually true in your life? Whenever I counsel people that say they want to ask Jesus into their heart, they want to get saved, that they want to, whatever it may be, a lot of times I say, all right, so you know the right answers, especially with church kids. You grew up knowing that you're a sinner. You grew up hearing that Jesus loves you anyway. And you grew up hearing that you have to repent of your sins, ask Jesus into your heart. You know all of that. But the question is it real in your life? Are you actually sorry for your sins? Are you actually going to say, Jesus, I'm done sinning? Or is it just that, Jesus, I'm sorry that I got caught. Please don't punish me. I want to keep on doing it, but I don't want to be punished for it. Do you actually want that? Is it actually true in your life? And so as we look at Behemoth and we see the strength and we see that God still has to provide, even for this beast of a beast, we look at it and we see, I also am in desperate need. No matter how strong I think I am, no matter how smart I think I am, no matter where I think I have arrived to, I am in need of You. Because I don't have an arm like God's. I can't make people that are proud be humbled. I can't do all of that. He then goes on to talk about Leviathan, which is, Leviathan is an animal that's like, who or what is Leviathan? Leviathan is kind of one of almost the center point of the book of Job, not front to back, but it's kind of one of the highlight, kind of the climax of the book. And Leviathan shows up actually in other places in the Bible. If you, he's already mentioned it in Job chapter 3. He's already said, Let those who curse days condemn it. Those who are ready to rouse Leviathan. He's already talked about who Leviathan is, what Leviathan is. And if Behemoth was maybe a hippopotamus, Leviathan has been likened unto a crocodile. Or Leviathan has been likened into a dinosaur or maybe a dragon. There's also the idea that Leviathan is just a mythological creature made up for stories. And we'll get to that in a moment. Now, to go ahead and tell you, I think maybe Leviathan was actually a dragon. And you're like, what? The preacher thinks there were real dragons? Think about this. And all throughout creation, all throughout the world, you hear stories about a worldwide flood. Why do you think the whole world has stories about a worldwide flood? Because there was a worldwide flood. And so while they attribute it to the wrong things and they don't get the details right, they knew something about that. Same way with other biblical stories. Including the idea of dragons kind of show up all around the world, even though dragons supposedly never existed. But maybe it's that dragons did exist once upon a time, but they don't anymore. I don't know, but I don't want to get so bogged down into what it is that we miss the bigger point. In secular culture, or in other words, in the culture that was not directly of the Bible, Leviathan also existed, and maybe by a little bit different name. The Baal cycle, now, if you want to get into some ancient Near Eastern religions, Baal worship was one of them, and Baal had this Baal cycle. Every year, Baal would die, and then he would come back, and then he would win. And so at the Baal cycle, Baal ended up fighting against something called Lotan, which is another way of saying Leviathan. And Leviathan and Mott, they kind of formed a team, and Baal had to go fight them. And so Baal triumphs over Lotan. It's a little bit different if you look in the Enuma Elish, which is from Mesopotamia. There, like the Assyrians had Ashur, which was kind of the protagonist in that. And so once again, there is this dragon creature that is defeated. Even in the book of Psalms, we see a couple of times where Leviathan is talked about on repeat. In Psalm 74, verse 14, he says, "You crushed the head." He said, going back to verse 12, "God, my king, is from ancient times performing saving acts on the earth. You divided the sea with your strength. You smashed the heads of the sea monsters in the water. You crushed the heads of Leviathan. You fed him to the creatures of the desert." So here, Leviathan is a sea monster, a many-headed dragon-type creature, this serpent-type creature. A twisting serpent is how he's described elsewhere. In Psalm 104, starting a little before verse 26, he says, "How countless are your works, Lord. In wisdom you have made them all. The earth is full of your creatures. Here is the sea, vast and wide, teeming with creatures beyond number, living things both large and small. The ships move about, and Leviathan, which you form to play there." Leviathan says he just plays there. That's where Leviathan goes to play, this mighty sea creature. As Behemoth was strong on the earth, yet needed God, here Leviathan, who can put a hook and tie down his tongue with a rope? Can you put a cord through his nose? Later he says, "Can you play with him like a bird you put on a leash for your girls? Can you fill his hide with harpoons and spears?" Because he's got scales that are impenetrable. His heart is as stone, and he seems to be undefeatable. He breathes fire. Out of his nostrils comes smoke. No one is ferocious enough to rouse Leviathan. Who can stand against me? You see, as he's got this sea creature, sometimes seen with many heads, whether it did or not, this dragon-type creature with the scales that seems to be impenetrable, yet God is the one that did easily what mankind cannot. In Isaiah 27, it says, "On that day, the Lord will with his relentless, large, strong sword will bring judgment on Leviathan, the fleeing serpent, Leviathan, the twisting serpent. He will slay the monster that is in the sea." And then if you keep going, you can see in Isaiah 51:9 that it talks about how he will defeat the serpent. And so God does easily. He's the only one that can beat Leviathan. The only one that can beat this creature that looks like a dragon with scales and breathing fire, whose heart is strong and billows smoke. Mankind can't do it. But this is what God said in chapter 41, verse 11. "Who confronted me? Who found guilt with me? Who contends with me that I should repay him? Everything under heaven belongs to me. Who is it that confronted me? Who is it that wanted to challenge me?" See, God started by asking him, "Who is this fault finder? Who is this fault finder? Who is this that obscures counsel without knowledge? Who is this that comes and says that, 'God, you are not acting just'? Who is this, and what are they going to do about it?" Because at the end of the day, that's what we want to ask. Whether it be whenever we go to get our dollars, we want to say, "Oh, but that's what I want, that's what I need." Our minds start twisting it and manipulating and saying, "I got to have that." And we start justifying it in our mind while we do what we do. And we start saying, "Well, I know what's going on in the world, and I'm not happy about it. And if God would just listen to me, if I was in God's shoes, oh, what I would do about that." And we can easily, in our hearts, that is deceptive, go and we would leash out our own version of justice. If we only had the power, if we only had the knowledge. But the problem is, we keep trying to take what we don't know and do what we can't do to fashion an outcome that isn't even what we need or want. Again, we try and take what we don't know, what information we are already lacking, and we try and do something with it, but we're not even powerful to do what we want to do with it. And then if we were able to do it, it still wouldn't be what we needed or wanted in the end, at the end of the day. Because that's who we are. And that's who God is. We are the creature and He is the creator. He is the one with the knowledge. He is the one with the strength. He is the one that is able to do it all. In Jeremiah chapter 17, the heart is deceitful more than anything else and incurable. Who can understand it? But I, the Lord, examine the mind and I test the heart. Give to each according to his ways, according to what his actions deserve. See, our hearts are deceitful and our mind ain't far from it. But God sees our heart and he examines our mind. And he gives to each according to what they deserve. So we go back to Job and we look and we see how Job was upset about his situations. Okay. But he starts trying to budget it out and assign this to God. And he started trying to assign blame to God. And started to try to bring bad upon God. Because perfection is perfection, and you can't blight perfection. You can't mark, you can't scar, you can't say anything against perfection. We don't really understand what true perfection is. Oh, in our mind, if something is perfect, we give it maybe a mint rating. We have rating systems where it's mint or it's perfect or it's new instead of like new. We have all these different kinds of rating systems. But yet we recognize that even something that is perfect, oh, they're perfect. Oh, it's perfect. It was wonderful. Whenever we start inspecting the fine details, we can see that maybe there's this one little smudge and it's okay, but we can still call it perfect. Or we can say, oh, this is a perfect coin, but we know that the elements that are inside it, if you break it down to the copper or the nickel or whatever it is, maybe there's an imperfection there. Yeah, but it's so small, we can still call it perfect, even though it's not really perfect. And whatever idea of if this was the perfect date, it was, you know, what is it, April 27th or whatever, it was the perfect date. Or it was perfect, but yet whenever we know that perfect isn't really perfect, whenever we talk about anything that is of this world. God created the world perfect, but then sin messed it up and everything else along with it. And that's why anything that is created cannot be perfect, because it has all been scarred and messed up. If we want to know what actual perfection is, we have to go to something that predated creation. Something that never was created. The only thing perfect is God. Because when he came to Job and he said, who is this that obscures my counsel with that knowledge? Where were you when I made the earth? Where were you when I made the stars? Where were you created the animals? Where were you when I put the blood in blood vessels to carry the oxygen so that your body and muscles could move? Where were you when I designed sodium that is bad for you and too much consumption, but without any of it, then you're still going to fall apart? Where were you when I said that the waves can come this far but no further because there's got to be land and there's got to be water? Where were you when I said the earth and the moon and the sun are in perfect relation with each other? Where were you when I did any of that? You don't know, Job, so get up off me with all you're talking about. I know it all. I know I'm good. You don't know because you were not there. You were not omnipresent, always present, everywhere present. You are not omniscient. You aren't all-knowing. You aren't always there. You don't know all things, and you are not omnipotent. You don't have the power. And we can be thankful that we don't, because we would mess that up too. They say power is corrupt, but perfect power creates absolute corruption. And the same with us. If we had it, then we would mess it up entirely. If we want to know what a good life would be, if we want to know what the better life would be, if we want to know what the best life we can have is, it is not one where we've got the power. It's not one where we've got the knowledge. It's not one where we've got the time to do what we want to do. None of that is what will get us to where God is. Adam and Eve sinned whenever they said, oh, I can be like God. And they tried to do it of themselves. And you and I mess up when we look and we say, I could do it like God. I could be like God. I can control it myself. God came to Job and gave him the gift of a humbleness. He told Job, look, when you see a proud person, humiliate them. When you see a proud person, humble them. And that's what God did for Job. He saw a proud man that wanted to blame anybody but himself, who said, this situation, I've got to assign blame, and I don't know where I'm blaming it, but I know I ain't blaming myself. And so God took him, that proud man, and he brought him to a place of humbleness where he realized he didn't have the knowledge. He didn't have the power. He didn't have any of that. But yet he revealed himself as the one that did. And I want to tell you today, I don't know what's going on in your life that you want to be different. There's probably something in your life that you would like to be different. And I ask you, don't blame God for that in the sense that, God, this is not what I wanted. This is not how I wanted it to be. Because God has thoughts that are above our thoughts. Not just different than our thoughts. They're above our thoughts. And so while we may not know this side of heaven, why in the world that happened, that's where we trust in Jesus. My God, my Savior. See, we want to say, I trust you for salvation, because we know we can't save ourselves. But in the little things, do we trust in him? In the little things, do we say, God, because that's how it is, I know, a lot of times in my life. The big things, I say, God, I know I can't handle this. But in the little things, oh, don't worry, God. Take the day off. Kick your feet up. Eat a cheeseburger. It's fine. I got this, God. I'll handle it. I'll handle this, and I'll get back to you on the big things. But God says, no, trust in him always and continually. For we are not perfect, but he alone is. I ask you this morning, do you know that you aren't perfect? You have to get lost before you can get found. Jesus said, it's not the healthy that I came for, but the sick that need a doctor. And so do you know that you can't save yourself? Do you know that no matter how hard you try or how much you give or how much you serve, that you will never make yourself fit for heaven? That you will never be able to do enough apart from Jesus? For you are not the perfect and sinless sacrifice, only Jesus was. And do you also know that he loves you enough that he died for you? But for those of you that are believers, if you don't know any of that, then please, let's talk. You need to be saved. You need to confess and say, God, I'm not perfect, but you are. God, my righteousness is as filthy rags, but God, I need your righteousness. And you need to not only pray and say, God, I'm sorry, don't punish me. You need to say, God, I'm sorry, because that ain't right, and I want to live right. I want to live for you. But then for those of us that are believers, are there things that you're holding on to that you are not trusting in Jesus for? Times when you are finding fault with the faultless, where you're finding blemishes where there are no blemishes, where you're assigning blame to God when the blame is not his. Are you discontent with the knowledge and the power and the presence that he's given you? Or instead, are you trusting in him? He didn't say that everything would go swimmingly if you were a believer. He didn't say that if you are a righteous man or a righteous woman, that don't worry, God will keep giving you thousands and thousands of sheep, and God's going to give you great health, and God's going to protect your loved ones, and God's going to do and give you land, and God's going to do all of that. He didn't tell us that. But he said, look, I know more than you know, and so if something happens in your life, you can call it bad because sin is bad, but know that I am going to use even that for my glory and your good. I know the big picture and not just what you're going through right now. Do you trust me in that? So maybe this morning you just need to come and you need to pray at the altar and say, God, I am not trusting you in this situation. God, I'm trying to do it all myself. I'm not trusting you. God, I'm trying to conquer problems that are yours. I'm trying to do things that, and God, I just stop and I put my faith and my trust in you. Maybe that's what you need to do this morning. If you want to join the church, if you just need somebody to talk to, I'm here to talk. There's all kind of people around the room too. There's my wife. I'm going to call out a woman just because I'll call her. If you're a woman and you're like, I'm going to go talk to him, then go talk to Rochelle. There's lots of other people too that would love to talk to you. Because Christianity is meant for us to be together, and there are a lot of people who know Jesus would love to talk to you and pray with you. But whatever it is that God leads you to do, I pray that we would listen and not just know what we're supposed to do, but that we would actually trust through obedience.